This is Precepts Audio Message PA-428. Nathan C. Johnson, Bible Teacher. For all those who love our Lord Jesus Christ in truth.
Matthew chapter 27. And we had seen the last time the Lord on the cross, and we had discussed the darkness that came over, this mysterious darkness that came over the land for 3 hours. And of course, we don't know what exactly caused it or what it symbolized or why it was only the second half of the crucifixion. Then he cried out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And we discussed that that was to show that as he had always been the perfect word, the expression of God, and yet in taking sin on himself and in dying, he did not express God, so he was forsaken on the cross for our behalf, even though he is God. This was a strange and unnatural thing, like an arm being cut off. But he was cut off as he took sin and death upon himself. So those who stood by, probably the Romans who couldn't speak Aramaic, thought he was calling for Elijah, gave him this drink of vinegar and waited to see if Elijah would show up, which of course he didn't. Then he cried again with a loud voice and yielded up the spirit. And then we saw these strange phenomena that happened. The veil of the temple tore from the top to the bottom, this huge veil. The earthquake, the rocks tore open, the graves were opened. And many bodies of the saints which slept arose and came out of the graves after his resurrection and went into the holy city. And I suggested that probably this means their graves were torn open at this time, and then they rose from the dead at his resurrection. So Matthew just kind of connects the two here because he doesn't want to interrupt talking about Christ's resurrection to talk about resurrections of other people. He wants to focus on Christ's resurrection. So even though this happened at the same time Christ's resurrection happened, he moves it back to here so he doesn't have to interrupt that later event to talk about it. Then we have the testimony of the centurion, probably in charge of the crucifixion, when he saw these things and said, truly this was the Son of God. So he saw these things and he believed that. And then we read about the women who had followed Jesus from Galilee serving him. And we know from Luke that many of these served him financially. He was financially supported by a lot of wealthy women. And among them was Mary Magdalene. Talked a little bit about her. Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. This is probably the James of the 12, but not the most famous one, but the James the less. And then the mother of Zebedee's children, which of course would be the mother of James and John. And we don't know for sure what her name was. Then we read about Joseph of Arimathea, who went to Pilate and strongly requested the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave it to him. He took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and laid it in his own tomb, which was unused, and rolled the stone over the door. And Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there watching what was going on. So that's as far as we got the last time. Verse 62. Now the next day that followed the day of the preparation, the chief priests and Pharisees came together unto Pilate. So we read about the next day, this was after the Lord was buried, which is said that followed the day of the preparation. Well, this is basically the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And that always immediately followed the Passover. Remember, Passover was one day, and then the Feast of Unleavened Bread was the following day. They came right after. Now, this Feast of Unleavened Bread was 7 days long, and from the first day to the last day of the feast, there was to be no leaven found in their homes. Now, the first day of Unleavened Bread was a high Sabbath, or a feast Sabbath, a festival Sabbath. And that meant that no matter what day of the week it fell on, it was a Sabbath. We would call it a holiday, of course. You know, we have the weekend where you have off work, and then if you have a holiday that's during the week, you have off work then. Well, it's the same thing with their Sabbath. You'd have your Saturday Sabbath when you wouldn't work, but then if you had a feast day Sabbath, it could be any day of the week, and you wouldn't work on that day. And it didn't matter which day of the week. So in this case, I believe that this feast day Sabbath was on a Thursday. And then the Friday in between, the women would have gone out, bought the spices, and prepared to decorate his body on the day that the markets were open. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been a market day for them to buy spices and ointments and so forth. And then Luke tells us that they rested on the weekly Sabbath and then went to decorate his body. So I think the timing really only works out if he died Wednesday evening and then was in the grave Thursday, the high Sabbath, Friday, the day they bought the spices, Saturday, the weekly Sabbath, and then rose on Sunday. Now we read that the chief priests and Pharisees came together unto Pilate. Now this is the first time the Pharisees have been mentioned in connection with this injustice, this whole conspiracy. Yet we would contend that the elders of the people mentioned all throughout chapters 26 and 27 were probably largely made up of Pharisees. So they were a critical part of the conspiracy to murder the Lord. So the chief priests and Pharisees came together unto Pilate. So this would be as a delegation, they came together to him. This is the word sunago, for a gathering together, related to synagogue, of course. And this is the only gospel in which we read of this delegation and its actions. And I think that makes sense when we realize that the Gospel of Matthew was written mainly to the Jews. And this portion is included in Matthew in order to dispel a false story that was spread among the Jews by this confederation of the chief priests and Pharisees, as we're going to read about it in chapter 28. So the Lord refutes this false report, and he puts that refutation in Matthew, the gospel written to the Jews. But other than Matthew, we don't read about this at all. It's really not important in any of the other gospels. So what did they say when they gathered together to Pilate? They said, verse 63, saying, "Sir, we remember that deceiver said, while he was yet alive, after 3 days I will rise again." So they say to him, "Sir," or "Lord," "Master" is probably more the idea. They didn't really have a word for "sir." "We remember that deceiver said," or Bullinger says, "we are reminded that deceiver said," probably by someone who heard him say it. Now notice that they're able not only to remember accurately what he said, but even to understand what he meant by what he said when they want to. So when his words were twisted at his trial, they well knew that twisting was lies, that was not what he meant. So they say, "We remember that deceiver said," or "imposter," would be another translation. And Seller says they still have to vent their spleen, even after he's dead. "So we remember that deceiver said, while he was yet alive, after 3 days I will rise again." Now we don't have a record of him saying these exact words to the rulers, though we do have a record of him telling his disciples this, surely enough. So when might the rulers have gathered this? Well, they might well be referring to the sign that he gave them in Matthew chapter 12, verses 39 through 40. "But he answered and said unto them, An evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign, and there shall no sign be given to it but the sign of the prophet Jonas. For as Jonas was 3 days and three nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." So these words were spoken to certain of the scribes and Pharisees. And remember, these were the same ones who claimed that his miracles were done by the power of Beelzebub. So that could be when they had heard about this 3 days rising again, and they understood what the sign meant, that he would be in the heart of the earth 3 days and three nights. So they understood that he meant that he would rise from the dead after that. So they show that they were capable of understanding his words. They understood his sign. And they show it here. They realized he'd been saying he would rise again after 3 days. Verse 64, "Command therefore that the sepulchre be made sure until the third day, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away, and say unto the people, He is risen from the dead, so the last error shall be worse than the first." So they tell Pilate to command or order this. And this same word is used when Pilate commanded the body to be given to Joseph. So he commanded the body given to Joseph. Now they want him to command to secure the body in the tomb. Well, Pilate, seeing he took a side in a conflict, and he took the side of men he can't trust. So I wonder if he regretted his actions. Well, the sepulcher here is the burying place. The same word is in verse 61, a different word than in verse 60. They say, command that the burying place be made sure until the third day. Now notice this, we have two phrases. In verse 63 we have, after 3 days I will rise again. Then in verse 64, we have the sepulchre be made sure until the third day. Now, it's always the question that we have to ask is which one of these, when the Lord said he was going to be 3 days and 3 days in the heart of the earth, when these religious leaders said he said I was going to rise from the dead after 3 days. Is that literally true, or is on the third day he will rise again? Is that literally true? Which is a figure of speech and which is literal? Because, of course, if you rise on the third day, you don't rise after 3 days. You rise during 3 days if you rise on the third day. So which is, and if you rise on the third day, you don't rise after 3 days and three nights. So which is the figure and which is literal? And I believe that the rising on the third day was a figure. And the nearest I can figure out as to why it was a figure, and there's nothing really biblical for this, but it seems that it came out of a superstition that some Jews apparently had, that when a person died, his spirit would try to get back into his body. Like your spirit always leaves when you dream and then it comes back. Well, it leaves when you die and then it wants to come back, like when you're sleeping, and it can't figure out why it can't get back in. But then after 48 hours, it gives up and goes back to God. So they thought this is why Elijah and Elisha could have raised people from the dead in the Old Testament. They did it within 48 hours while the spirit was still trying to get back in. And after 48 hours, they couldn't have done it because the spirit would have gone back to God. So this was a superstition. The Bible never mentions it, and it was a superstition. I don't think we have any reason to think it was true. But that seems to be both why the Lord waited 2 days before he went to raise Lazarus from the dead. Have you ever wondered why did the Lord want to raise Lazarus from the dead on the fourth day? Why not? Remember, he waited 2 days before going to Lazarus. Well, if he hadn't waited 2 days, he would have just gotten there on the second day after he died. Why did he wait to get there on the fourth day after he died? Why was that important? Well, it was important if they had this superstition that it wasn't as significant to raise someone from the dead on the second day as it was on the fourth. So I think he was waiting till they said a prophet like Elijah or Elisha couldn't raise someone from the dead because it was too long after. And I think that was probably the source of this third day figure of speech too, that the third day just meant after these totally, completely confirmed dead, not going to be raised from the dead, even Elijah and Elisha couldn't bring him back type of thing. It is best I can figure where this figure of speech on the third day may have come from. Basically just meaning once death is sure and certain and can't be reversed. But he was literally in the grave 3 days and three nights, as he said he would be. And as they said here, he said he would rise again from the dead after 3 days. So the third day is just a figure, and of course they want it, the tomb to be guarded not till the third day, but they want it to be guarded into the fourth day and maybe until they feel completely safe. So they want the tomb to be made sure until the third day, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away and say unto the people he's risen from the dead. And that phrase there is actually out of the dead ones. And that, of course, is a phrase they learned from the Lord earlier in his ministry. His disciples had been confused when he used that phrase. It was kind of a new phrase. But they, of course, they knew he and his disciples used that phrase. So they just imagined his disciples saying that after stealing his body. And then they say, so the last error shall be worse than the first. Now they say last, but this is the Greek word eschatos. And in this case, I think they mean the resulting error. The error that would result from this would be worse than the initial error. They thought that error would be overshadowed if the disciples did this, and people really thought he rose from the dead. Now, what did they mean by the first error, the initial error? Well, they probably mean the error of the people in supposing him to be the Christ, which they thought was an error or a deception he had practiced upon them. So notice again that in spite of all his miracles to prove who and what he was, they still don't believe that another miracle can happen now. They're only afraid of a deception. They don't think that he might really be who he said he was, and he might really rise from the dead like he said he would. These men lack faith completely. Instead, they trusted in their own cleverness and their what they supposed was their success in defeating God. So they didn't fear that he'd rise from the dead like he said, they just feared some deception. Verse 65, Pilate said unto them, Ye have a watch, go your way, make it as sure as ye can. So Pilate said unto them, Ye have a watch. Now, I don't think he means by that you already have one, but this means I grant you a watch. So this would be a group of soldiers to watch the tomb, a guard, with which to guard the tomb against any such grave robbing. And Bullinger says the word here, custodia, is a transliteration into Greek of the Latin custodia. And in the Latin they would have used a C, and in the Greek they would have had to use a K because they don't have C's. But a custodia, he says, was made up of four soldiers. So he gave them four soldiers to keep the tomb, and I suppose that would be enough that they could take turns on the watch at night. Some would sleep and some would watch and so forth. So he said, he grants them a watch, and then he says, go your way, go about your business. That's what go your way meant in their idiom. Make it as sure as ye can. Now literally in Greek is make it as sure as ye know. We would say as sure as you know how. So he says, do what you need to do to make sure that nobody can break into that tomb. Verse 66, so they went and made the sepulcher sure, sealing the stone and setting a watch. So they went out to the burying place, that same word again, and they made the sepulcher secure. They secured it as much as they could. They sealed the stone. And this would have been sealed with the emperor's seal, or the seal of Rome on it. And although that seal was made of wax, the idea was that if anyone broke that seal without authorization, they were basically declaring war on the forces of Rome, and they could expect no quarter from Rome if you did such a thing. That was what it meant to break the seal of Rome. So they would have sealed the stone, and then they set a watch. So this watch would have overseen and done the sealing, and then been in charge of seeing to it that the seal was not disturbed. Well, the Pharisees and the chief priests mean this, of course, for their own schemes, their own deceptions, their own plots, but it was good that they did this. Why? Well, because the stage was all set so there could be no deception. There could be nothing at all that would contravene the witness of the Bible to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. Because here was this Roman guard tasked with watching over this seal. And basically, if anyone broke that seal, those soldiers are supposed to dedicate their lives to finding who did it and executing them. And if they didn't, they were supposed to be executed themselves. That was the rule. If anybody broke that seal, You either killed the person who did it or you died yourself. So there was really nothing more that men could have done. And when they completed this, men had done their worst. They betrayed and murdered their own creator. And so sin had really reached its nadir at this point. So what had started with the rebellion, orchestrated by Satan and followed by willing dupes, Adam and Eve, in the garden, had now reached its absolute lowest point. That mankind had not only rebelled against God, they actually put their God to death. But no, God is about to act to turn around the tragedy started all the way back in Genesis 3 and brought to its absolute lowest point here at the crucifixion of the Lord. Now he's going to turn man's foul victory into his gain. And he's going to bring about his own victory in spite of all that his enemies can do. And I believe this was really the turning point of history. From that point on, God is advancing. Up until the cross, we have a continuous history of man's failure in spite of all the good God does on our behalf. And in spite of all that God does to arrest it, mankind just gets worse and worse and worse. And in spite of all God's plans and all God does, it just results in failure after failure after failure. But when we reach the cross, it seems the ultimate failure, and yet it's all turned around at the resurrection. And from then on, I think we have a very different picture. We have God after the cross, after the resurrection. We have God succeeding in spite of all man can do against him. And so, in spite of all man's sin and all man's rebellion and all man's wickedness, God succeeds over and over and over again. He succeeded in the Acts period. He's succeeding even today in showing forth the riches of his grace each and every day. He's succeeding every day in what he set out to do in this dispensation. In spite of all man can do against him, man can't stop him from showing grace. And then someday soon his kingdom will come and man will not be able to stop that either. So the great turning point is about to be reached. And the decline that started at the fall and reached its lowest point here is about to be turned around, completely turned around and reversed. Chapter 28 and verse 1. In the end of the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to see the sepulcher. Now we have in the end of the Sabbath. But we know that the Sabbath ended at sunset, and then he starts talking about dawn. So Matthew seems to be giving a composite here. Now it's like, this is written, of course, but we think of a film where, you know, a film maybe shows a composite where you see the sun setting, and then it shows it dark, and then it shows the sun rising the next morning to give you the idea of time passing or something. So he says, but the end of the Sabbath, and drawing on or dawning into the first of the Sabbaths, came Mary Magdalene. So it's like we're to imagine the sun setting over the tomb, and then the next day the sun dawning and rising over the tomb, and now the two Marys coming to see the sepulcher. So he's kind of carrying us through a period of time with these few brief phrases. Now where it says, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, that is really a fanciful translation of the Greek, which doesn't read anything about the first day of the week, but reads one of the Sabbaths. Yet this is a problem because the Sabbath had ended the evening before, as is stated earlier in the verse. If it was the end of the Sabbath, then it couldn't be the Sabbath again. Well, you say, well, it could have been the end of the feast Sabbath and then the weekly Sabbath starting. Well, that's true. Except for the fact that Luke 23 and verse 56 assures us regarding the women, and it says, and they returned and prepared spices and ointments and rested the Sabbath day according to the commandment. So Luke is very specific in telling us that the women did not go to the tomb on the Sabbath day to anoint his body. They waited till the Sabbath was over. So how could they, now Matthew doesn't say so, but Mark and Luke say they were going to decorate his body on the day of his resurrection. But they didn't come to the tomb till the Sabbath was over. So what does this mean? They came on one of the Sabbaths. Well, I think to understand this, we need once again to understand the Old Testament feasts of the Jews, which I think most Christians, that is the last thing they understand. You know, that's understandable. We understand our own holidays, but we probably don't really understand other people's holidays. I don't know that I really understand Boxing Day, for example, and probably a bunch of other holidays I don't really understand from other countries. So it's maybe understandable the Christians don't understand Jewish holidays, and yet this is important if we don't want to understand what was going on here at the Lord's resurrection. We need to understand the Feast of First Fruits, or the Festival of First Fruits, and the Festival of Weeks. Now, Leviticus 23, verses 10 through 11 tells us about the wave sheaf. When the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, of course that's sons of Israel in Hebrew, the representatives of the people, and say unto them, When ye be come into the land, which I give unto you, and shall reap the harvest thereof, then ye shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest unto the priest, and he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord, to be accepted for you. On the morrow after the Sabbath the priest shall wave it. So the Lord's command, this was while they were still in the wilderness, but he said, When you come into the land, and when you reap your harvest, then when your harvest is reaped, you bring a sheaf of the first fruits. And the priest will wave it on the morning after the Sabbath. So that means by our calendar that would be Sunday, since Sabbath was Saturday. So sometime after Saturday at sunset, the next morning, and he doesn't specify whether it's before or after dawn, so it could have been when the Lord rose from the dead around the same time, or it could have been later. You're supposed to wave this sheaf before the Lord, always on Sunday, always the day after the Sabbath. So that was the wave sheaf. But then Leviticus 23, 15 through 16 tells us about the Festival of Weeks, where it says, And ye shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that ye brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete. Even unto the morrow after the 7th Sabbath shall ye number 50 days, and ye shall offer a new meat offering unto the Lord, and so forth. So from the day after the Sabbath, the Sunday, when you waved the wave sheaf, you were to count 7 Sabbaths, and then after the 7th Sabbath, the following Sunday, the 50th day, you were supposed to celebrate the Festival of Weeks. So you would count 50 days, the first day being the wave day of the wave sheaf, the Festival of the Wave Sheaf. So this would all be counted from Wave Sheaf Day, which was a Sunday. And I believe ultimately this is what is meant by one of the Sabbaths. Because this means that this was the first day for counting the 7 Sabbaths, the Pentecost, or the Feast of Weeks. So one of the Sabbaths was day one, not the first Sabbath, but the first day, the Wave Sheaf Day, the day you would start counting up to Pentecost, the Feast of Weeks, the 50th day. Now today, when agriculture in Israel has little meaning to your average Jew, in the Jewish culture as a whole, they always count the wave sheaf day, the first fruits day, as happening on the Sunday during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That's when they always do it. They mark it on their calendars. If Passover is on this day, and then this is the Feast of Unleavened Bread, well, this has to be first fruits, because that's the Sunday during Unleavened Bread. But it seems very doubtful to me that that's the way it was when Israel was actually in the land. Because it should be obvious that you can't wave first fruits until the harvest actually comes in. So when you would have first fruits, it would be dependent on your agriculture. And that could vary widely, not just because of the year, but remember that they used lunar calendar. They had real months, not our fictional months we just make up out of thin air, but they had real months based on the moon. And so your full moon would start the month, or your new moon start the month, your full moon would be halfway through, and then your next new moon would start the next month. Well, since our year are not divided into exactly 12 moons, they would have intercalary months or leap months, a 13th month that they would have to add every few years to get back on schedule. Well, you can see if you just had a leap month or if you were just about to have a leap month, when your harvest came in could vary widely from that as well as just from the weather that year. So I don't think there's any way that they could just pick a day and say this is where we're going to wave our first fruits. It would have to depend on the agriculture. It would come in around Passover time, but I don't know that it would always come in for them to do that. Of course, now, since there is no temple, there is no priest to wave the first fruits, they can put first fruits whenever they want and put Pentecost whenever they want. And so they decide to start it from the Sunday during Passover. But the Lord never commanded it to be on a particular Sunday. He just said after the harvest comes in, then on that next Sunday you wave the first fruits. But regardless, whether it was always the Sunday during unleavened bread or not, it was that way this year, I believe. First fruits was during unleavened bread. It was that Sunday after the Passover. And notice that this means that the Lord died on Passover, being the ultimate fulfillment of the Passover lamb, and then he rose on first fruits, becoming the first fruits of those who rise from the dead. So he became the living fulfillment of both feasts. But I think that's our key here. One of the Sabbaths means day one for counting the Sabbaths. It doesn't mean it was actually a Sabbath, because like I said, that would clash with Luke telling us that the women rested on the Sabbath. So one of the Sabbaths means day one for counting the Sabbaths. And it was a Sunday, as we would call it. We read, in the end of the Sabbath, as the Sabbath ended, and then it began to dawn toward one of the Sabbaths, the first day for counting the seven Sabbaths. Then we read, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary. Now we spoke of these two back in chapter 27 and verse 56. This other Mary was the Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, not the Lord's mother or Martha's sister. And we have so many Marys among the Lord's followers. This is obviously a very popular name at the time. So Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came and says to see the sepulcher. And take careful note of what this says. Both Mark and Luke talk about the women coming to decorate the body. But Matthew only says they came to view the sepulcher, to see it. So I believe that Matthew was a return to the tomb by these two women after they had already been there before and had learned of his resurrection. They came back to see it all again. And then they met this angel and received this message. Now, I don't believe that all four Gospels record for us the same visit of women to the tomb, because the details of the visit are very different. I believe Mark and John basically record the first of the visits. Reading Mark 16, when the Sabbath was past, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome had brought sweet spices that they might come and anoint him. And very early in the morning, the first day of the week, they came onto the sepulcher at the rising of the sun. I think that means before the sun rose, because very early in the morning seems to mean very early in the fourth watch. So very soon after he rose from the dead. They said among themselves, who shall roll away the stone from the door of the sepulcher? And when they looked, they saw the stone was rolled away, for it was very great. And entering into the sepulcher, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, clothed in a long white garment, and they were affrighted. So notice they find the stone rolled away, go into the tomb, see a young man, one angel, sitting on the right side. And he saith unto them, be not affrighted, ye see Jesus of Nazareth, which was crucified. He is risen, he is not here. Behold the place where they laid him. But go your way, tell his disciples and Peter that he goeth before you into Galilee. There shall ye see him as he said unto you. And they went out quickly and fled from the sepulchre, for they trembled and were amazed. Neither said they anything to any man, for they were afraid. So we read that the women didn't really believe it. They ran away, they didn't tell anyone. They were too frightened. Now John tells us, John 20, verse 1, the first day of the week cometh Mary Magdalene early, when it was yet dark, unto the sepulchre, and seeth the stone taken away from the sepulchre. Then she runneth and cometh to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved. So I believe this tells us that Mary came. This was again, well, it was still dark, early in the morning. We know she came with Mary, the mother of James and Salome, but it seems while they went into the tomb, she ran to find Peter and John and didn't go into the tomb herself. Mark doesn't tell us that, but he doesn't say He just says they went into the tomb. He doesn't say it was all three. And he doesn't mention the fact that Mary didn't go in. She ran to find Peter and John. Then, of course, later she came to the tomb and stood weeping. And finally she stooped down and looked in the sepulchre and saw two angels sitting, one at the head and the other at the feet. So this was the first she had looked in the tomb. They ask her why she's weeping. She turns around and sees Jesus. So even though John and Mark record the same visit of the women, they record very different details. Then Luke 24 tells us, now upon the first day of the week, very early in the morning, they came onto the sepulchre, bringing the spices which they had prepared, and certain others with them. And the they, according to verse 55, was the women also which came with him from Galilee followed after. So it was all the women who came with him from Galilee, along with some other women, apparently from Judea. So this was a large group of women. This wasn't three women. It wasn't one woman. It was everyone who came from Galilee, along with some others, probably from Judea. So a large group of women. Probably the other three were getting an early start. They couldn't sleep. They were so sad the Lord was dead that was keeping them awake. We can see how sorrow could do that. They decide to go and get an early start before the other women come. These other women come, maybe at the agreed upon time. They found the stone rolled away from the sepulchre, and they entered in and found not the body of the Lord Jesus. And it came to pass, as they were much perplexed thereabout, behold, two men stood by them in shining garments. Notice, not one man sitting, two men standing. And as they were afraid and bowed down their faces to the earth, they said unto them, why seek ye the living among the dead? He is not here, but is risen. Remember how he spake unto you when he was yet in Galilee, saying, the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and the third day rise again. And they remembered his words and returned from the sepulchre and told all these things unto the 11 and to all the rest. It was Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary the mother of James and other women that were with them which told these things unto the apostles. So, this larger group of women is not afraid, runs away, and doesn't tell anyone. And notice, Mary the mother of James is with them. But if she really didn't tell anyone, she maybe joined the larger group of women at the time they were supposed to go to the tomb, figuring maybe she was crazy, it didn't really happen. When she got there, it wouldn't have been that way. She was just imagining things, I don't know. Or maybe she waited to see what the other women thought of it without saying anything, like Mark said. But this larger group of women doesn't panic like the smaller group of women earlier. They go and tell the apostles. And they're joined by Mary Magdalene. I don't know if she was in the group or not. Or if she, after she saw the Lord, she rejoined them at some point. And they went and told the apostles. But then I think what we have in Matthew is we have Mary Magdalene and the other Mary going to see the sepulchre. So I think after telling the apostles, and the apostles don't want to believe them, don't listen, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary decide to go back and look again. They want to see it again. Well, you can understand that. If I had gone to the tomb and seen it empty, I might want to go back and see it again myself. So I don't think it should surprise us that women would go back to see it again. Notice it doesn't say anything about going to decorate his body this time like it did in Mark and Luke. They were just going to see the sepulchre. And I think that's because they already knew his body wasn't there. They just wanted to see it again. So if we take careful note of the details here, and then later, as we'll see, they departed quickly from the sepulchre with fear and great joy and did run to bring his disciples word. So after this third visit, they're getting really excited. Mary's seen the Lord. Now they see him a second time. They're becoming filled with joy. They're not running away afraid to tell anyone. They're not going to bring his disciples word. They're running to bring his disciples word with joy that they've seen the angels again and so forth. So I think when we pay careful attention, we see there were three visits of the women. We can see the order. We can see how it all went. And again, intelligent design in the Gospels. The Gospels don't see fit to have to repeat the same story over and over. They tell us different parts of the story, and we have to weave them together to get all the details. Because God's guiding hand is deciding which Gospel has which detail, and he can do that. These were not four independent writings. They were on the part of the authors, but each author was inspired by the Holy Spirit. and he was guiding each author as he saw fit. So these women were coming to see the sepulcher, to see the tomb again, after they'd already been there and seen it was empty. Verse 2, and behold, there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it. So here we have the third of three earthquakes in Matthew, which is the only gospel to mention earthquakes. We first had the earthquake during the storm at sea in Matthew 8:24. Then we had the earthquake at his death in Matthew 27:54. And now we have the earthquake at his resurrection in Matthew 28 and verse 2. Now Jesus also prophesies earthquakes in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21, but those aren't actual earthquakes happening at the time. So that's why I say only Matthew talks about actual earthquakes happening at the time. So there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven. But I believe that what the Old Testament calls the angel of Jehovah in the Old Testament was Christ himself, who is the messenger, the agent of God in human form. And he would come to earth as the angel of Jehovah. But this, of course, is not he. The Greek reads angel of Lord, and there is no the. So we can make it an angel of the Lord. This is not the Lord himself. But an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone. So he descended from heaven. Now he might have come down from the sky, but of course he came out of that place called heaven as well. We don't know exactly how the angels do that, how they travel from heaven to earth, and seem to do it in a short time. You don't have to hop on some spaceship and travel for centuries to get from there to here or something. How they do it, we don't know. But he descended from heaven. He came, he approached, proserchomai, one of Matthew's favorite words, as we've talked about. He approached and he rolled back the stone from the door. So the question of the women in Mark 16:3, who will roll away that stone from the door for us? It was answered in a way they never anticipated. Probably weren't thinking an angel would come and roll away the stone for them. Well, considering how huge this stone was, as I said, these stones were meant to deter grave robbers. And once they were rolled over the door, you'd need a large group of men with a lot of equipment to move it. And yet this angel rolls it away all by himself. Well, either he was a very powerful angel, or else he was using power that God had granted him to use. But he rolled back the stone from the door, and he sat upon it. And the door, of course, would mean the entrance to the tomb. Now, verse 3, his countenance was like lightning, and his raiment white as snow. So his countenance means his form or his external appearance. The word is only used here. His appearance was like lightning, and I think that means shining that brightly. Of course, lightning just goes off for a second and then is done. But he was shining like lightning that was continuing. Well, this was a divine messenger, and that's a very, very bright light. And his raiment, that means his outer garment or cloak, was white as snow, or dazzling as snow. Now, since they had no chemical bleaches like we have, their cloth couldn't achieve a really white. It was an off-white at best. So a truly white would have seemed especially supernatural to them. Of course, the fact that it was glowing like lightning would have added to it, but just the pure white would be something that they were not used to in a cloth. Then verse 4, and for fear of him, the keepers did shake and became as dead men. And for fear of him, and considering the context, a stronger word like terror is probably in order. The keepers shook. Those were the guards. Those placed at the suggestion of the religious leaders. Well, no guards could stand up to God's messenger. Now, shake means that they trembled or quaked like you would in an earthquake. And then they became as dead men. We would say they fainted dead away. And notice, of course, that this incident is only in Matthew. The rolling away of the stone is only mentioned in Matthew. Mark and Luke and John just tell us the stone was rolled away. It doesn't say how it happened. But we're actually told how it happened in Matthew, which is the only gospel to tell us about the guard. And since the guards were the only ones who saw the stone rolled away, it's the only one who mentioned it being rolled away. Yet notice that even in Matthew, the actual resurrection of the Lord Jesus is not described. In Mark, Luke, and John, we just have the women getting there after it's all over and find the tomb empty and him gone. Matthew, we have an angel rolling away the stone and sitting on it, which the guard saw him do, but we don't have the actual resurrection described. Why is that? Well, no one was there to see it. See, in all four Gospels, I think God's primary concern when it comes to the resurrection is providing for us the evidence, because our faith hangs on this. If Jesus Christ was a very good man, and even if Jesus Christ was the God-man, God in human form, if he died but he didn't rise from the dead, well, his death really was useless. The resurrection is the key. The resurrection is everything. Now, plenty of people observed him dying on the cross. But no one observed him rising from the dead. And yet these Gospels are giving us the evidence. Now, telling us about his resurrection would be telling us something for which there is no human evidence. No one but God saw it. And of course, God saw it and could tell us what it looked like. But it wouldn't prove anything, since it would just be God's word for it. There would be no witnesses to back it up. So the Gospels don't tell us about the resurrection. They just tell us about the events surrounding it, the aftermath, the appearances of the Lord afterwards. And all of this is the evidence for us that it actually happened. Rather than describing the event, wouldn't be evidence, since no one saw that. It would be God's personal testimony, but it wouldn't be evidence backed up by witnesses. Now, this rolling away the stone, too, was not the resurrection. And the fact is that he may have already been resurrected and gone once the angel came down and rolled away the stone, passing out of the tomb just as he had already passed out of the grave clothes. He passed right through the grave clothes and left them behind. He could as have easily passed out of the tomb. He didn't need the angel to roll the stone away so he could get out. I think he had already gotten out. But the angel rolled the stone away, not for the Lord to get out, but for men to get in and see the fact that he'd risen from the dead. So the angel is rolling away this stone to put the resurrection on display, not to let the Lord out of the tomb. And so I think the Lord was already out when he did it. Verse 5, and the angel answered and said unto the women, fear not ye, for I know that ye seek Jesus, which was crucified. So here we read that the angel answered, and of course he's speaking to the women, not to the guard. So we note here that verses 2 through 4 are an interpolation, describing what had happened much earlier, before the women arrived. But it's because of what the angel did that the stone was rolled away, and it's because he sat down on the stone that they now find him sitting on it. Now, the other records have them see angels in the tomb, not sitting on the stone. Well, angels can apparently make themselves visible or not as they wish. So apparently the angel sitting on the stone didn't appear until now. Now, Mark, Luke, and John, of course, don't relate how the stone was moved, for they don't talk about the witnesses of the stone being moved, the keepers. So they just mention the women getting there, seeing it moved. So the angel answered and said to the women, fear not ye. And fear is related to the noun in verse 4. Don't be terrified. Don't fear. Don't flee. For I know that ye seek Jesus. Now notice here, and as I said, I believe this is the third visit to the tomb and the last that we have recorded. There's no word whether they expected to find him alive or dead. And I believe Mary had already seen him alive, according to John. This is a later visit than those in Mark, Luke, and John. These women were both returning after having been and seen that he was gone once before, and Mary having actually seen him alive. So he says, I know that ye seek Jesus, which was crucified. Now, of course, you recognize that one who was crucified, as the Lord was dead. And death, as we know it, is a final thing, something that we are powerless to change. I can, for example, kill a mosquito, a very simple thing to do, something you often do in a place like where I live. Yet once that mosquito is dead, I can't even bring a little tiny insignificant thing like a mosquito back to life again. I can kill it, but I can't reverse it. And our power over death only goes one direction. Now this is how it was with the Lord Jesus Christ. There were people who had given up their all to follow him. But now, the wicked leaders had taken him and crucified him, and he was dead, and it seemed to be all over. But now, suddenly, he's alive again, because he's risen. He's no longer in the state of death, for he's risen from it. Now, people will sing songs at Easter time. They'll sing, "Lo, in the grave he laid, Jesus my Savior. Waiting the coming day, Jesus my Lord, up from the grave he arose." But do they really believe that low in the grave he lay? Well, no, if you really question them on it, they don't believe it. They believe he'd gone somewhere else. And it was not Jesus their Savior who lay in the tomb, it was just a husk of his body. And the real Jesus was off somewhere else. If that is not the truth as it's presented by Scripture, he was dead and he arose. And if the dead rise not, that even Christ and those dead in Christ have perished, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15. So he was crucified, he had been dead, but verse 6 he says, "He is not here, for he has risen, as he said. Come see the place where the Lord lay." So this was a place where a crucified man had been laid, and yet the angel described to them a resurrected man. Now this word, "he has risen," means to rouse yourself or go into action. I've mentioned it earlier in Matthew multiple times. Here, however, in the context of death, to arise and go into action, for a dead person, well, that takes on a new, deeper meaning. For someone who is dead to arise and go into action is much greater than from someone who is alive to arise and go into action. But that is what the Lord had done. And this is resurrection from among the dead, and this is resurrection life. One who was dead, being aroused, rising up, going into action. Now this, "he is risen, as he said," the Lord predicted his own resurrection. The same word that spoke the heavens and the earth into existence by a word, that same word said that he would rise from the dead after 3 days, and just like in creation, he said it, and it was so. So they say, "Come see the place where the Lord lay." Now, the Bible doesn't waste words here telling us about them obeying this command and going in and looking at the place. But we would assume that they obeyed the command and did so. And God doesn't waste words by talking about what they saw. He gives that in other Gospels. And we can read about what the place where he lay looked like in the Gospel of John, which was written before Matthew, I believe. So Matthew doesn't waste words by telling us what they saw. Instead, he goes right on to what the angel told them after they obeyed his command and looked. He says, verse 7, "And go quickly, and tell his disciples that he is risen from the dead. And behold, he goeth before you into Galilee. There shall ye see him. Lo, I have told you." So he tells them after they've seen the place where he lay to go quickly. And according to verse 8, they obeyed this command and did go quickly. So they are to go quickly to tell his disciples that he is risen from the dead. And from is apo, meaning out from among. Apo, from among. So the dead remained, but he was no longer among them. He left them behind. He left them still dead. And he came out from among them. So he is risen from among the dead. And behold, he goeth before you into Galilee. Now both Matthew and John speak of the Lord appearing to his disciples in Galilee after his resurrection. Whereas Mark never mentions Galilee. He just tells how the Lord appeared to them while they ate, probably in Judea. And Luke tells about him appearing to them in Judea. And they don't mention him telling them to go to Galilee and that he would appear to them there. But John and Matthew do. And in fact, both John and Matthew leave him and the Lord in him and his disciples in Galilee at the end. And only from comparing this to Luke do we learn that they then returned to Judea and saw him again there and saw his ascension from the Mount of Olives. So they were to go into Galilee and meet him there. And he says, "There shall ye see him. Lo, I have told you." So he had carried out his commission and told them the instructions he was to tell them. Verse 8, "And they departed quickly from the sepulchre with fear and great joy, and did run to bring his disciples word." So they departed quickly, again as they were instructed, that same word quickly, from the sepulchre, same as Matthew 27:60, the burying place, the monument, the tomb. "And they left with fear and great joy." Now, fear mixed with joy is a far different matter than fear all by itself. Fear mixed with joy is a great thing, whereas fear by itself is not so great. But these women are filled with fear and joy, and they run to bring his disciples word. And those people who want to make it just one visit to the tomb, Mark tells us they ran away and told nobody. Matthew tells us they ran away to bring the disciples word. They ran as fast as they could to bring the disciples word. Well, I compared this talking with one man recently who tried to tell me that it was all the same visit. And just maybe they didn't tell anybody for a while and then they did tell someone. I said, well, let's take all these statements as referring to the same thing. Say a woman tells me a secret, says, "Don't tell anybody," tells me the secret. "Don't tell anybody. I don't want anybody but you to know." And then she starts hearing that there are other people who know it. She hears from other people, they know the secret. She comes to me. "Did you tell my secret? I told you not to tell anybody." I'm the only person she told. "Say, no, I didn't tell the secret." You say, "Well, I'm hearing it from other people. They couldn't have known it but from you." "Well, okay, maybe I kept it for a little while, but maybe I told some people eventually." Well, she goes out and she starts finding that everybody she knows the secret. She comes back to me and I say, "Well, yeah, actually, as soon as I left you, I ran as fast as I could to tell as many people as I could. But I told you the truth the first time. I didn't tell anybody." You know, those two really don't go together. These were different visits to the tomb and different responses of the women. You can't mash them together, make them the same thing. You don't run away and not tell anybody. Run as fast as you can to tell somebody at the same time. It just doesn't make any sense. So this was a different visit. All the details compared tell us this was a different later visit of these women. Verse 9, "And as they went to tell his disciples, behold, Jesus met them, saying, All hail. And they came and held him by the feet and worshipped him." So they ran to tell his disciples. And this is the same as verse 8, "to bring his disciples word." So our translators just translated it slightly differently like they like to do. The word is apangelo. And in Greek, they like to use the same word over and over in a paragraph. They thought it was clever. In English, they say that's bad English and tell you not to do it. So our translators will translate differently. And sometimes we lose the thread. But as they went to bring his disciples word, behold, Jesus met them. Means he encountered them. Or Bullinger says he confronted them as coming from an opposite direction. And the word, if you follow it out, can mean a hostile encounter. Of course, clearly this is not a hostile encounter, but a friendly encounter. So he encounters them saying, All hail. In Greek, this is kairete, which means literally rejoice, which was a common Greek greeting. That would be kind of a nice way to greet somebody. You know, instead of saying hi or hello, you say rejoice. Well, you're suppose, especially if you're excited to see the person, it's a good way to greet him. But even though it was just a standard greeting, and it probably had lost a lot of its meaning, just like when we say goodbye, we don't think much about God be with you. We're just saying goodbye. We aren't thinking about what it means. In fact, we've compressed it so much from God be with you that I guess most people don't even know that's what goodbye means. But they probably had maybe stopped thinking about kairete means rejoice. They're just, that's what you say to say hello. But I think God gives this word its full meaning. He does mean rejoice, and certainly they had every reason to do it. Now, the only other two people who said rejoice in Matthew, interestingly, were Judas when he met the Lord, and the mocking soldiers when they were making fun of the Lord. Well, there really wasn't any reason to rejoice when they used it, but when the Lord used it, he had the final say, and he had the actual reason to rejoice. So he said, rejoice. And they came and held him by the feet and worshipped him. Now this is very interesting that they came and held his feet. Because when Mary appeared to the Lord, remember what I'm saying is an earlier appearance in John 17, when she realized it was Jesus, she turned herself and said to him, Rabboni, which is to say Master. Jesus saith unto her, touch me not, for I am not yet ascended to my Father. So he told her not to touch him, since he was ascending to his Father. Yet here, he allowed these women to touch him and hold him by the feet. Now this would seem to me to imply that between his appearance to Mary in the garden and his later appearance to Mary Magdalene and the other Mary here, as they were running to bring his disciples word, he had done what he told Mary he was going to do and had ascended to his Father to present himself in the heavenly temple as the priest, having completed the sacrifice. And then he had returned to earth and to appear to the women. So we talk about his ascension, but that doesn't mean that was the first time he ascended after his resurrection. I think he had already ascended between his visit to Mary in John 20:17 and his visit to the two Marys here. He had ascended, appeared before God, and then come back down to see these two women. And he could do that. He could go to heaven as fast as he wanted and come back. So they came, they held him by the feet, and they worshipped him. This is, again, proskuneo. And it's not just oriental obeisance, it's worship. Verse 10, then said Jesus unto them, be not afraid. Go tell my brethren that they go into Galilee, and there shall they see me. Well, they formerly had fear and joy mixed. Now he tells them to have fear no longer, just joy. Now he says, go and tell my brethren that they go into Galilee, and there shall they see me. Well, earlier the angel said, go and tell his disciples. So is this the same as his disciples, and he's calling them his brothers? Or does this mean what we would more literally think of as brothers? Now the Lord had already said, those who do the will of God are my brothers and sister and mother. So he could certainly mean his disciples. Yet I think it's interesting to consider what had happened to his brothers after his resurrection. We learn in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 7, when Paul is making the list of all the witnesses of his resurrection, and to the Corinthians, who were perhaps even more prejudiced against women than the Jews were, where women had more rights in Israel than they did in other places. So right into the Corinthians, Paul doesn't list any of the women, just the men. But in 1 Corinthians 15:7, he says, after that he was seen of James, then of all the apostles. And he seems to mean the James, his brother. And it's very interesting that if we compare his brothers during his ministry, in John chapter 7, we read that his brothers told him to go up to the feast and present himself to the world. In other words, to the religious leaders of Jerusalem. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. John 7:5, for neither did his brethren believe in him. So we read that his brothers didn't really believe that he was the Christ, the Messiah. They didn't really believe in him at all. He was their brother. They maybe thought he had delusions of grandeur or something. They didn't believe in him. And yet when we read in Acts 1:14, after his resurrection, when all the disciples are gathered together, we read, "And these all continued with one accord in prayer and supplication with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brethren." So notice here, we had the 12 in verse 13. We had the list of the 12, or actually the 11, since Judas was dead. We had the 11 continuing with one accord with the women, Mary, his mother, and his brothers. And here I think it would be very hard to say that this doesn't mean his literal brothers, since they're listed right there with his mother. So it seems like his resurrection made a big difference to his brothers. Before his resurrection, they didn't believe in him. They kind of made fun of him. After his resurrection, they were right there with the 12 and their mother. They believed in him. And could this be because he appeared to them and they saw him? Could they have been among the 500 brethren who saw him at once that Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 15:6? Saw him at once in Galilee? So it seems to me quite possible that the Lord literally wanted his brothers to go to Galilee too at this time, as well as his disciples. So, yet at the same time, I acknowledge he could have called his disciples his brothers. So, I don't know that for sure, but he could literally mean his brothers. And he says, "And there shall they see me." And literally that's, "There also shall they see me." So could this be because his brothers would also see him along with his disciples? And this was a second command. It didn't just mean tell his disciples like the first command. Well, I don't know. But they're going to see him in Galilee. We'll read about that in, like I said, later in Matthew. Well, we only have 10 verses to go in Matthew. We have the response of the watch and then the meeting of the Lord with his disciples in Galilee. And some very interesting verses to finish off the book. We're out of time for today, and so we will complete the Gospel of Matthew in our next study.